This new book is the ultimate coming of middle age story. Annabel Gurwitch.
Oh, thank you so much. I love having inspired, falafel and a movie. The funny thing is when I was doing dinner and a movie, I actually ran into some trouble with Ted Turner once. My trouble with Ted was that during the holiday season, it was the Christmas Hanukkah season, we were doing these, we used to do these little promotional things, and I had a menorah, and I was roasting a kosher hot dog over it. And I got a call from Mr. Turner's office, and he said, I think Jewish people are going to be upset by this. I said, well, Mr. Turner, the show was on Friday night on television. Jews that are watching television on Friday night those Jews aren't going to be upset about it. I think we're okay with them. And he didn't really say very much, but they kept that commercial on. A small victory, just a small victory there. Hi, thank you so much for coming out tonight. It is sort of funny doing an author talk in a bar, but then again, not really. I know a lot of authors who do a lot of talking in bars. Let's face it, the two often go together, I've been having the best time today in Ann Arbor. I've been to the Detroit, I've done a bunch of book festivals in Detroit, but I've never been here, and everyone said, you're going to love it. And sure enough, the minute I got to town, I'm like, oh, this is my kind of town, little stores and coffee and more coffee and more coffee. My God, you people. That's why this show, I'm like already sweating because I had my right amount of coffee. And I also went to Zingerman's. Okay, so let me just say, it's amazing I'm not in sweatpants tonight because I have reached the age where if I eat a cashew, I change sizes. This is why, this is one of the reasons why I wrote this book, because it's a real thing to hit middle age. And I understand now why it's called hitting middle age. No one says gliding into middle age, sauntering into middle age. No, it's hitting because it's a wake-up call in so many ways. And we'll talk about that tonight, but it was really fun because when I went to Zingerman's, I talk about how when I go to a bakery now, I visit the breads of my youth. And, I'm a nonfiction writer, but today I became a fiction writer because now they are the breads of my present. Oh, yes, I had to sample everything. It was really fantastic. And they were dinner and a movie fans. So Zingerman's is following me on Twitter. New York Times bestselling author, who cares? I'm being followed by Zingerman's. That's the big achievement. So, it's just still a funny thing. This is my third book now. But still, when people refer to me as an author, I look around for a minute like, what? Who are they talking about? Because I started out as an actress. And some of you know me from dinner and a movie. And of course, that was all even a second career for me as an actress, because I started out as a Shakespearean actress in New York. I'm a classically trained actress whose education is meant for nothing. I still return to the stage when I can. But that was my first love, was acting. And the reason why I wanted to go into acting was because it was the life that I thought was the furthest from anything that had to do with math. I just was trying to avoid a life with numbers and calculations. And of course, that is one of the ironies of hitting middle age, is that everything is numbers now. Everything is tracking your cholesterol numbers, tracking your glucose numbers, the right dosage of omega oil and vitamin A and vitamin D. And then there's the age of retirement, which keeps rising every year. And then there's the $200,000 it's going to cost to send my son to college, and the amount of money I'm going to have to save so I don't end up in an elder hostel in Uzbekistan. It's all numbers. It's really that's part of the wake-up call. But I did start as an actress, and it is It was kind of, one of the things I loved about acting was I loved language and I loved the word. And if you're acting in Shakespeare and if you're acting in Chekhov, and I did a lot of avant-garde theater, and so I was doing very pretentious stuff, Brecht and Buchner and, you know, lots of German expressionists. But I loved language. And it just, a funny thing happened when I came to California. I just started working in comedy, and it was not the plan. It just, everything sort of shifted. And I do feel like there's something about comedy that is, I don't know, there is a great tradition of Jewish comedians. I happen to be married to a Jewish comedian who introduced me to a lot of Jewish comedians, and that became my world. And I don't know, I think it kind of rubbed off on me. It's funny when you do the Jewish book tour, because there's such a dichotomy, there's such a variety of the kinds of the ranging intellect of the Jewish reader. I have done events now with authors, great authors, all of them great authors, provocative people writing about the nature of life itself, relationships to God and the universe, and also books about diabetes. You want to get a bunch of Jewish people really interested? Talk about statins. I did an event in St. Louis with a book about diabetes. And the irony is, of course, there's also someone on the panel who's written a book about the joy of Kugel. So you've got one on one hand, we love Kugel, but we also really want to read that book about diabetes. It's so funny. It's and also about, you know, about thought. We're Primo Levi. We love all these. We were such a range of kind of interests. And I fell into writing, though, when I was, it was actually before Dinner and a Movie, when I started publishing essays. And I like the form of essays. Are you guys essay fans? Do short stories, essays. An essay to me, it's a polemic. It's like an argument. And I was that kid in high school on the debate team. Couldn't stop. I mean, it got out of hand. You know, I'm the one coming home saying, you know, I'm making my case all the time. Making my case why I should go to the party without parental supervision. Oh, yes. And of course, this is something that I'm getting, you know, back at me now. My son is 16. I'm going to sigh for a second. 16 is so hard. And I'm trying to be, you know, both a Jewish mother, you know, and communicate the values that we hold dear of studying and all those things. But I also, you know, we live in a certain time. So I'm digressing for a minute. I bought him condoms the other day. 16 years old, you know, what's worse is not having condoms. Although I'm 53. And so I did at one point, I said something just terrible. Like teenage pregnancy wouldn't be that terrible because I thought, oh my God, how am I going to get grandchildren? I was so old when I had him, but I don't really want to do that. So I bought him condoms, and here's the conversation you never expect. I don't usually tell this story, but we're in a bar, right? It's a book event in a bar, so I bought him condoms, and he said to me, Mom, why did you buy me magnums? I said, I'm a Jewish mother, I like to think positively. I didn't know what to do. I don't know how to do this. I just thought, you know, I'm gonna think, you know, what if I didn't buy the role? You can never do it. You can never get it right with your teenager. And I'll talk about that in a minute, because there is stuff about being a parent at this age. But I was just going to say just a little bit about my background as a writer. I'm interested in a polemic, what I call a comedic polemic. So a comedic argument towards a point. And this really started when I was anchoring a show on HBO called Not Necessarily the News. I don't know if you guys saw that show, but I love news and I love making fun of the news and satirical stuff. Bill Maher and I are good friends, and we have that in common, which is why I do his show. We made a little film together on Funny or Die, which you can see, it's just out now. And when I was doing that show, I thought, I could do this. Now, I just think that I was really lucky that I hadn't gotten a part on ER, because I might have thought, brain surgery, I could do this. Because actors, we believe, we get so convinced by our performances that, you know, this could have been very dangerous. But I happen to have had the good fortune to have been working with Harry Shearer. Are you Harry Shearer fans? Ah, he's so great. In a terrible movie he directed. But no matter, it was still a wonderful experience. And he introduced me to people at NPR. I became a commentator in NPR writing. And if you're ever, for some reason, stuck in a snowstorm, we're in Michigan, they're archived there. But that was when I first started writing, and that was a dream job. And I started publishing, and my first book is a book about being fired, and it was inspired by being fired by Woody Allen. And yes, I just leave it at that. Ooh. Yes, but that's a book of a collection of essays and what happened was, this is when I really felt I started to develop a voice as a writer, because I thought, this is as terrible as it was being fired by someone who at the time I really worshipped, I really idolized. I really saw it as a way. I knew when it was happening. I had this moment where I changed from being an actress just thinking, oh my God, this sucks, I'm being fired by Woody, to thinking, this is a really good story, because I'm going to have to, after a certain amount of drinking, a certain amount of ice cream eating, a certain amount of weeding in the garden, pulling out weeds, you know, I'm going to have to learn how to live with this. I'm going to have to, unless this experience could kill me, you know. And so I saw it, and because, you know, it was someone so famous, I knew that instinctively that I would be able to use this as a way to get other people to tell their stories. So in that book of essays, and then I made it into a documentary, it sort of became a Studs Terkel-like project. I went around the country. I came to East Lansing, and my first experience with Michigan, and I interviewed people on assembly lines. I did at GM. I interviewed people all over the country at job fairs and a lot of comedians. Jeff Garland is in the book. He talks about being fired while he was on stage doing stand-up. He was in between, like, his two shows, comes off stage, and they say to him, Jeff, it's just not working out. He says, okay, I'll go to my hotel and pack. And they say, no, we've packed for you. Wow, you know, you have to, you know, because comedy is a great, and show business is a great way to fail, and you have to keep failing and failing and failing and learn how to deal with that. I also have there's an interview in the film with, I don't know if any of you are fans of former Labor Secretary Robert Reich. I love Bob. We became good friends doing that project, and we did a bunch of events together. And Bob was fired. Robert Reich was fired when he worked in the Reagan administration as a solicitor general. And he was asked to argue in front of the Supreme Court to get rid of the 1st, 4th, 5th, 7th, and 9th Amendments to the Constitution. And he said, I don't think this is working out for me. But that book is really about, to me, taking the personal experience and putting it in the larger cultural zeitgeist. And that's, and about really humiliating things that happen to you and how transformative that can be. And that's what interests me as a writer and as a comedic writer. And so my last book, You Say Tomato, I Say Shut Up, the title is by my husband. I will never have a better title than that, let me just say. He and Ben Stiller were partners, and they started the Ben Stiller Show together. And actually, when we started writing that book together, I called Ann Mirror, who's, you fans of Ann Mirror? I love Anne. Anne was one of my first people who heard my first piece on NPR, the very first one I did, and she called me and she said, Annabelle, keep writing. That meant so much to me. So I called Anne to say, Anne, Jeff and I are following in yours and Jerry's footsteps. We're going to work together doing it. She said, oh my God, Annabelle, what a terrible mistake. Don't do that. Don't do that. Of course, I found out later. It's like opening a shoe store. I mean, writing a book together, it's a he said, she said about marriage. And of course, here's how my mind works. When we wrote that book, as we're writing it, halfway through, I thought, a he said, she said, wait a minute. That means he's always getting the first word out. no way, right? We're going to change it. So the second half of that book is a she said, he said, but that still didn't make me happy because that meant I didn't get the last word. That book is a book about how we wrote that into, we're like 18 years, I always forget, into a marriage. And that was about 15 years in. And I thought, you know what, middles are so, no one celebrates the middle. You've got your wedding section in the newspaper, your divorce section in the Huffington Post. There's no section like, yep, still doing it. They're still here. There's not a lot of love for that. There's also not a lot of recognition of how hard and murky those waters can get. So that book includes the fantasy of the middle of marriage. And one of the fantasies goes like this. So I'm with my husband. We're in some really romantic place. We're far away from home. We're having a fabulous dinner, great wine, great Pinot Noir. Suddenly, a foodborne illness hits him, not me. Why? We don't know. But it's fast. It's over very fast. It's painless. It's over very fast. I go home alone and have a lot more closet space. The fantasy of a middle age. Oh, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. But kidding-ish. And then this book. This book came about in a way, those last two books, I set out to write those books with a mission. This one surprised me. What I was doing when I started this book was I was writing a series of essays that I thought were unrelated. But what happened was, as it got to be 2-3 essays in, I realized what I was creating was really a portrait of middle age. It all started to have a theme to it, and I started writing to this theme. And I realized, that other people were going through this too. I mean, this is what my interest is. So I would be talking to friends, and I remember my friend Carrie said to me, she said, you know, it's so crazy. The world is seeing me in a different way. I was in the airport, and my shirt was unbuttoned, and no one noticed. Not a single, and I was wearing my La Perla, and not a single person, because I'm invisible. My friend Tanya said to me, this is when I was sort of gathering thoughts, like, is this something that we all can relate to? Because otherwise I feel like I would just be writing in my journal, right? Or Twitter. Twitter is now people's journals. It's really crazy. Some people just should not be on Twitter, myself included sometimes. But Tanya said to me, I know I've passed into a different age because women are now giving me their seats on buses. Yes. It's like, oh, yes. This is a different time. And, you know, there was a profile of me in the New York Times, and they said something that I actually hadn't, they codified it in a way that I was so pleased, was that they had said that I'm arguing in this book, hopefully in a very funny way, but that we don't have a template for aging. And I am writing about this very unique position that many of us are in, which is called the sandwich generation. So we don't have a generation before us to look to of how to be this age. When my grandmother was 50, she had a slew of grandchildren. And, you know, the lifespan was so much shorter. She was on the other side of that. You know, she was heading down that road. When my mother was 50, she was a grandmother. I have the thrill of going through menopause while I have a child home who's going through puberty. He's raging, I'm raging, he has too many hormones, I don't have any. At any given moment, I might have more chin hairs than my son. This is a very unanticipated moment in life, you know? So I realized I was a child of the 70s, and in the 70s there was that commercial for Clairol, and they said, oh, you're not getting older, you're getting better. And I thought, wait a minute, I might be getting better, but I am also getting older. And I started to feel like we were doing ourselves a disservice by not recognizing this age. You know, there's that saying, and it's a very popular saying these days, 50 is the new 40. And I thought, no, you know, first of all, when you're 50, people who are 40 do not think that you're the same age as them, unless you are very tattooed. very, very tattooed. So I thought, this is a canard, and we are telling ourselves this, and it's only making it harder to sort of navigate this world. And so I started taking these stories, and I started writing them to this point. And so the book is a series of essays. It's, I think, 13 essays. If you've read it, then you know. I can't remember. Okay, the menopausal brain things. You know, I can't. I think to myself, I used to speak French. I used to speak Spanish. Now my entire brain is filled with internet passwords. That's, I have all everything I used to know. All I have now, it's all passwords and usernames. It's all left behind now. You know, and that's one of the, there are things in the book that are particular to women, but there are things that I think men will relate to too. Don't let the pink panties scare you on the cover. There are always men who come to the book signings, and I know, I recognize them. You know, even if I didn't see that they were men, they're the people holding the book with their hand over the panties. But this, there's a number of experiences that I think are common to both of our genders, and one of them is this way that we are in a different world than we used to be in, and the internet passwords is like the tip. It's like the tip of the iceberg for that. The other day, I had to call my cell phone provider because I couldn't remember my username to pay my bill online, and they tell me that they can't accept my payment unless I give her the username, which I don't even remember what I created it to be. I have no idea what it was. And I said, are you telling me that random people want to call up and pay my bill? And she said, yes. Oh my God, please, please. That sounds fantastic. How do I get someone to do that? Please take my money. You know, one of the things I write about, and that's certainly a cross-gender experience for sure. One of the things I write about, things that I think, I like to say they range from the neurotic to the biological, because that is the range of experiences. So I am writing about things that are, I know there's a certain vanity, and I don't think it's just because I live in Los Angeles. I think, you know, everyone goes through the experience where you're looking, you're walking through your living room, and you look, you catch sight of yourself in the mirror, and you say, what's my mother doing visiting here? What's my father? Is he, oh my God, it's me. You know, because our brains are different than the way we look. We are, it is a mixed experience, no matter how you feel. You, well, first of all, I do think you feel differently, and the world sees you differently. And one of the ways, and one of the stories in which I discovered that was when I took my son to a concert. That, if you are the parent, how many people here are the parents of teenagers or have been the parents of teenagers? You know, there is a very small window of acceptable behaviors for the mothers and fathers of teenagers. I'm not allowed to sing in front of my son. I chew too loudly. The sound of my voice is grating. I'm not allowed to be nude within 100 feet, even if the door is closed. Can't ask questions about girls, can't ask questions about school. It's a tiny little thing. The longest conversation we've had is we were on an 8.5 hour car ride down the California coast, and we debated whether or not it was ka-ching or cha-ching when making the cash register sound. Ka-ching. And for two of those hours, he was sleeping, but he managed to communicate his disdain through hostile body language. So hard. So I'm going to make this moment with my son. I'm going to grab this moment. So I get tickets. Here's where the Shakespearean background comes in. To a punk band called Titus Andronicus. I'm like, Titus Andronicus, that's so cool. It's named after a Shakespeare play. This is going to be fantastic. And I convinced him to go because he was grounded. We have a rule. If you are grounded, you are allowed to go out with your parents. So that night, was, I think this was the first story in this collection that I wrote, because it was just one thing after another that happened that made me realize I am living proof of Einstein's theory of parallel universe. It's like age has spun me in an alternate universe that exists at the same space-time as the universe of young people, but they just can't see me anymore. So it started in the car on the way there. I was talking to him about how different things were when I was growing up, how we didn't have cell phones or answering machines. And if you liked someone, you could imagine that they had called you, even if they hadn't. Because you didn't have, because you wouldn't know, and you could experience anticipation. And how Carly Simon and the Heinz Ketchup Company had gotten a great song out of that kind of ennui, and that song would never be written today. And he's like, whatever, who's Carly Simon? Terrible, right? And then I said, wait a minute. Before caller ID, you could call someone you liked over and over and hang up. And they would never know it. Now that didn't sound so terrible to him. But, you know, and then he said to me, Mom, you're so old. When you went to college, did you take a plane to go to NYU, or were they invented yet? And I realized, okay, I am becoming that person. You get to a certain age where you think about things, and you mark and you compare your experience between now and then. And that is part of the half century experience. Words like nowadays come into kids today. That's certainly one. In my day, those just weren't in my vocabulary before. Of course, I say in the book that those are words that put you in AARP territory. And of course, if you think that you are not in that range, and I did title the book The Edge of 50, because I do consider the edge of 50, and this book is for you if you're anywhere between maybe 40 and death, because it's that middle range, you know. You know, if you think that you're younger than you are, the AARP, they track you down. You get that email. And they find, it's like, I think the AARP is a part of the NSA. If they're not, they should be. Who has gotten the AARP email? We've gotten that email. My email, first of all, there's an AARP couple, and they are pictured dressed in the most depressing, neutering outfit. The outfit screams, here, take my libido and hold it for the rest of my life, which won't last that much longer anyway. Very unattractive outfits. And they offer you, when you join, a refrigerated tote bag. I mean, what's that refrigerated part for? Medications. That refrigerated tote bag is there to remind you that your health is your top concern while traveling. Now, my health is my top concern while traveling now. I was diagnosed as pre-diabetic upon turning 50, but I don't want my luggage to remind me of that. Couldn't they just give you a wine of the month club membership, a gym, something? I mean, but no, they find you out. But so that night of the concert, we get inside, and as the band takes the stage and starts to play, of course, my son is not making eye contact with me at all, not even looking my way. I see the band, I hear the band starts playing, and I'm like, wow, they're so loud. Uh-oh. Don't tell anyone that you think it's too loud. And then I'm like, God, I can't understand the lyrics. Uh-oh. Another terrible sign of aging. And then I'm looking at this skinny punk rocker, you know, who's this guy on stage, and he's so thin, and all I can think is, I should take him home and pack him nutritious snacks for the road. Things have changed. Things have changed internally, even the way I think. It's not just the way the world looks at you. It's a different time. And that story to me, you know, that became one of, and there's a lot more things that happen in that story, became one of those stories that fits in the category of this book. There's a story in the book about going to the apple bar and falling in lust with my apple genius because I have reached the age where what I find a sexual turn on is a man who can fix my computer. And if he can program my smartphone, that's even better. Anyone, man, woman, anyone who can work a computer, fantastic. So, and at the Apple Genius Bar, I had one of, you know, the sex fantasy of a middle-aged woman. I realized, oh my God, I'm having a Mrs. Robinson fantasy. And then I realized I'm actually older than Anne Bancroft was when she played Mrs. Robinson. Terrifying. And then I thought, okay, you know, this was the time when 50 Shades of Grey became very popular. Now, I just want to say I am shade-free. I have remained shade-free. I have resisted. A little too tame for me, okay? I was in college, and I was in my 20s in the 80s, and I just thought it was a little tame. But I thought, you know, what's my version of 50 Shades of Grey? And so I write about the sex fantasy of the middle-aged woman. I think, where am I going to go with this guy? Can I take him home? I can't take him to my house at any given moment. There's a pair of Spanx crumpled at the foot of the bed. There's a tube of hormone replacement cream by my nightstand. My bedroom is a minefield of erection killers. Just ask my husband. What am I going to talk to this guy about? Am I going to say, hey, I have a mole that's changed shape on my back? And would he check it? This is going to be really tough. Plus, I haven't been nude in front of anyone other than my husband, my gynecologist, and women at the gym in 18 years now. It would take me 3 months, if not 3 years, to get into shape, to be with this guy. So I go through the whole thing. It ends up in a rock climbing wall in a hotel room where I'm standing on my good ankle. Okay, let me just say, the phrase good ankle is something that nobody understands until you get to this age. I had a couple years ago, I started playing tennis again, and it's been fantastic because one of the, you know, this book is Compliments, Indignities, and Survival Stories from the Edge of 50s. One of my survival techniques is that I do these exercise dates with my friends. It's less fattening. And although I still do the girls' night out drinking, I still do that. But we play tennis together, and I hurt my ankle. And this is one of those things that is one of those real biological changes. When you have an injury at this age, I go to the doctor, and he says, oh, you've got boomeritis. What? They actually have a name and a diagnosis for it. It means you're exercising like you think you're younger than you are. And the funny, and I ended up in the orthopedic boot, which I consider to be the must-have fashion accessory of middle age. And it never goes away. It's like when they, you know, when you go to a Chinese restaurant and they have the fortune cookie, and there used to be a game you'd play where you'd add in bed. You will have great success in bed. You will meet some stranger in bed. You know, now I add for the rest of my life. To things. I have a good ankle and a bad ankle for the rest of my life. It's crazy, you know? One of the things I write about in the book is about, and I don't know if anyone will relate to this, is aging out of my wardrobe and entering the Eileen Fisher years. Yes. You could wear Eileen Fisher, or you could leave your house in a duvet cover. This is the kind of thing they sell to women of a certain age, you know. And, of course, I have a little beef with Eileen Fisher, which is that she only has younger women on her website and her ads. Now, we know who you're trying to sell your clothing to. There's only one gray-haired lady on the Eileen Fisher website, and she's not even modeling the clothes. No, she's giving a video tutorial of how to tie a scarf. That tutorial lasts 6.5 minutes. I watched that. Do we really need a 6.5 minute video on how to tie a scarf. It's terrifying, let me tell you. She's dressed in black. And she's got no jewelry, very little makeup. She's got something I call the mandu, which is a look favored, a very close-cropped hairstyle. It's a look favored by Judi Dench, elderly nuns, and white pride militia. She ties knot after knot, and when I watched that, I realized, oh my gosh, first of all, I like scarves now. I wear scarves all the time. It's like my brain has changed and acclimated to scarves look great to me. But I realized when I was watching that the scarf has two purposes. One is to cover the gobbler. And the other is it adds some je ne sais quoi. And I know what the quoi is. The quoi is the last vestige of feminine flair for the pared-down wardrobe of the middle-aged woman. I leave my house most days looking like a plainclothes detective. Slacks, button-down shirt, jacket. And I thought, oh my gosh, I should be a plainclothes detective because I spend all my time looking for my keys, looking for my wallet. It would actually really make sense. There's a reason. There's other stories in the book that I felt, and some people have asked me about this, why do I include? I include some stories that have serious notes as well, because, and people say, why do you include that? And I think what really interests me as a writer and as a human is that line between comedy and tragedy. That's what you find, just going back to my acting roots, in Chekhov. You know, it's so terrible you have to laugh, or it's so funny that it makes you cry. You know, that's the kind of experience in life that I think is memorable and interesting. And so there are some stories about my sister and I are at the age where our parents are getting older, and we are helping them to get to the next place. They've moved, that we sold their family house, and that is an experience that I think is one I wasn't totally prepared for. And it just had so much comedy, tragedy. I show up at our parents' house, and my mother has all these things laid out in the garage, broken bowls. I couldn't even identify them. It was like they were items from Grey Gardens. It was like they came from Big and Little Edie's house. Like, what are these things? And I realized that the thing that I was most attached to, that I had to have, was an ashtray from the 1970s. That was the thing that smelled like my parents to me. This is where you get to that, you know, like, oh my God, is it funny? Is it serious? Is it funny? Is it serious? My mother was getting rid of so many things. I had to call her at one point and say, Mom, you're not going to be living in a yurt. Don't get rid of the bed. You will need that later. I lost an entire day to telling my parents that they didn't have to change their cyberspace address when they moved their physical address. They were convinced they needed new emails. Oh, it's so hard. You know, these things, these moments that you go through. There is a story about an assisted suicide that I did with a friend of mine. You know, this is an age where I say in the book, I know the good cancers and the bad cancers. I didn't know that when I was younger. All the cancers were the same to me. Now I know pancreatic cancer. If Steve Jobs couldn't get it, we know. And four friends of mine, we did this, and there were these surreal moments, and it was an amazing thing to participate in. And ultimately, it was incredibly life affirming because it was so real and so terrible and such a great act to have to be called upon to do and then to fulfill that. And there were these moments, though, in the middle of the night, I had to wake my friend up and say, Robin, don't die yet. I don't know your internet passwords. All of her data would have been lost. We couldn't get into her computer. I'm thinking, this is crazy. This is one of those things that you just can't make up, which is why I really think that, you know, this age is something to, you know, ultimately be reckoned with and not to glide over. You know, when people say, as I said, that, you know, 50 is a new 40, I announce my age. In fact, my business card now says Annabelle Gurwitch since 1961. Yeah, I'm like, you know what? I'm just throwing down the gauntlet. Of course, the thing that's a little bit upsetting is I had to stop giving the card out because I wrote an email address on it that I can't remember the password for. So I was passing this out and I realized I can't get emails people are sending me because I don't remember the password. So with my next card, I'll do one of my safe emails. Oh, it's ridiculous, right? So that's a little bit about this book. I hope, and about me as a writer, and I hope that you will read it and enjoy it and relate to it because that is what I wanted to write. I felt like my goal also was to reflect something I was going a little bit more populist than I felt Nora Ephron's work was. That was my goal. And I write about that in the book. I write about class and status and being part of a generation that has a really unknown future. You know, there's a lot of uncertainty. I say at one point in the book, I'm driving in my car and I pass a sign and it says, prepare for a longer retirement. And at the same time, I hear a story on NPR that says the suicide rate for people in middle age is up and researchers don't know why. Ask me. I know why. I just passed a sign that said prepare for a longer retirement. It's amazing that sign doesn't send drivers careening off the road like lemmings. You know, it is a terrifying and fantastic experience that I'm so happy to be here and to get to have this experience. But there is also this so many unknowns. And so part of writing this book was to give people a sense to everyone else who wakes up at 4 a.m. and for the 4 a.m. wake ups and reviews their life. There's actually a chapter called the 4 a.m. Club. I just started, I came on Dr. Oz's show the other day and we did a whole thing about the 4 a.m. Club and how you wake up at 4 a.m. and people do all kinds, you know, you go through. That's a great thing about being this age. I have more things to regret at 4 a.m. Oh, I could redo that till at least 7 or 8 a.m. every day and think of new things. But it was to give people a way of feeling not alone. I mean, that's what I look for in a book. It's funny. I mean, it isn't my friends who know me well have said, oh, it's not strange that you became a writer, because I was that kid also who I would pretend to be sick so I could stay home and read because I love books. And I tell you, it's interesting. There's been a lot of reporting this year, in fact, that there's been a little bit of people weren't sure what was going to happen to books. And that there's actually good news, which is that books are selling. Now, a lot of people read in different ways, and I'm so thrilled if you listen to my audiobook, if you can listen to my voice, good luck to you. I'm just kidding. It's fun to do those, and I like audiobooks. People read on Kindles, on Nooks, and different devices. I'm that girl. I like a book. I like to read in the bathtub, and I don't trust myself in the bathtub with an electronic book. You know, it's not going to be good. It's not going to happen for me. But I just love that people are reading still. There's, I mean, when you think about that, we are the only species that it makes me so happy. And it makes me so happy to show up here and to meet people who've read the book or who will read the book and who are here because they love books. It makes me want to jump up and down on my good ankle. It really does.